Okay, so last week we mentioned, we're here in the middle of Perek Lamed Beis. Last week we learned the first thing, which was really the yesod of Perek Lamed Beis. The first and major yesod which he was teaching, which was that why Mashiach is not a gradual thing, because it's a real remake of the world. If you remember, he couldn't just build it on what was there. It's really a remake. However, as I mentioned, there are many, many other things, like a slew of things, that that the Maharal discusses in the continuation of the Perek, you know, in their own way. And where I'm up to, if you're using the Hartman edition, is Umizeh Tavin, which is on page Tav, Resh Yud Zayin, the second column. And he was going to address here a lot of what he's going to talk about, or the points which are going to come up as he speaks about it, is the idea that David HaMelech, the Melech HaMashiach, was born from a remarkably difficult yichus. And the yichus was, he came from Rusa Moavia, a Moavite woman. Moavites, generally, we have a prohibition, Moavi, Amoini, Moavi, Bekal Hashem. Amoini, Moavi is not allowed to enter the Jewish people. Ad Olam, even a 10th generation, they're not allowed to enter the Jewish people. So everybody knows that the permission which was granted here was a chiddush that emerged in the time of Boaz when he married Rus, as a Kabbalah, perhaps a tradition from the Bezdin of Shmuel Haramasi, that it only applies to males. It does not apply to females. Still, remarkable that specifically from Moav, this person would emerge. Now, Moav has in it these various ambiguities. Okay, first of all, and the Maharal is going to be explaining these things, that's why I'm sort of trying to lay it out for us. First of all, again, Amoni and Moavi are generally forbidden to marry into the Jewish people. Moavite women, however, are permitted. Amoni and Moavi, in that sense, can be considered as being like anathema, like the very, very opposite of the Jewish people. At the same time, to some degree, they're not so far. Why? First of all, they are descendants of Lot. They are the children that Lot had with his own daughters. Right, so that's the very clouded and negative portion of it. But it was what Lot had after the destruction of Sodom in next week's Parsha, when they thought that the world was gone, and then they engineered this thing to be with him to be able to somehow continue the world. So they do come from Lot, who was connected to Avram Avinu, who was the family of Avram Avinu. And he was the family of Avram Avinu to the extent that the Torah forbids us from taking away the land of Amon and Moav, because it's Ki Livnei Lot Nesatia Yerusha. I gave it to the descendants of Lot as their inheritance. So you have no right to take it. You don't get your hands off of it. It's their inheritance. 10 nations' lands were given to Avram Avinu and to his descendants, 7 taken by the Jewish people, 2 taken by Amon and Moav, the descendants of Lot, and 1 taken by Edom, by Esav. Seir, we're not allowed to fight with them and take away their land either, until the time of the ultimate Gula. So therefore, you know, we have all of this stuff about Amon and Moav, you know, certain positive things, certain very negative things, and Dafka from this framework comes the Mashiach. How do we understand this? This is perhaps the major issue that he's going to be discussing over here with some offshoots. So let's read a little bit about what he says. Mizeh tavin atam, shamelech ha-mashiach yeh nolod me'uma acheres. This is the reason you have to understand why the melech ha-mashiach has to be born from another nation. David came from Moab. Shlomo, also, right? Shlomo, who was a descendant of David, that would have been enough, but he came from an Ammonis. Right now, really, this is inaccurate. Shlomo didn't come from an Ammonis. Shlomo came from Bathsheba. Shlomo married Naamah ha-Ammonis, and from her came Rechavam, who continued the chain from of there. He married Naamah HaMoinis. So these two kingdoms, Amon and Moav, right, both of them, both the children of Lot, both were grafts onto the Jewish people that produced the Melech HaMashiach. So he says, what's the reason? Shekasher Hashem Yizbach Reitze Lohaitzi Havaya Chadosha El Zetzer Charkova Minatei Acher She'ena Min HaRishayna. Of course, in some sense, the Goel has to come from the Jewish people. The Melech HaMashiach has to come from the Jewish people. But on the other hand, since what we seek over here is a renewal, a transformative renewal, the same way he explained last week that the world has to deteriorate down to the, you know, to the lowest level, so to speak, before it can sprout up again as the Mashiach. So it's not just the same old, but there's a Havaya Chadosha, there's a new birth, a new creation. That's what happens at the time of the Mashiach. So you can't have the Melech Mashiach of the Jewish people coming from business as usual, from just a normal continuation of the Yichus of the Jewish people. There needed to be some new burst, some new addition, some new ingredient that went in to creating this new being that would be able to bring Klal Yisrael into a new world order, into a changed situation. That's a core idea. Now, some of you may say, that sounds familiar. It should sound familiar. Maral spoke about that also earlier when he spoke about the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu got taken into the house of Paro. Right? That was also this notion of taking him out of the Jewish people, because within the Jewish people, they weren't being able to solve their own problems. Ein chavush matir atzmei mibeis ha'asurim. Right, the prisoner can't release himself from jail. Right, you need something to come from the outside. So there's a value to the outsider to bring some new energy to bear here. But that's not where he finishes. This is really just where the Maral starts on this issue. Right. Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit of citing what he says, and we'll try to isolate in a significant way the yesodos, the notion which he says over here, the foundational principles which he says over here. He says, first of all, we find the Gemara in Yevam Mesdarshins, v'nivruchu v'chok kol mishpachais ha'adama. This week's parsha, we learned it already yesterday at Mincha. Right? It says, Avram Avinu, part of his brachas was v'nivruchu v'chok, which simply we translate will mean, it will be blessed through you all of the families of the earth. That the Jewish people are the channel of blessing to every family in the earth. But the Gemara makes a play on words. Because lehavrich, the verb lehavrich, right? Levarech is to bench, to bless. Lehavrich is to graft. So the Gemara says, the drasha of enivruch uvecha is, they'll be grafted onto you, kol mishpachais ha'adama. What does that mean? So he says there's two brechais tovos, there are two important, good grafts that I have to indeed develop from you. Rus hamoaviyah and namo ha'amoinis. These are the two critical grafts that are going to play such an important role in spawning the future leadership, the Mashiach, the kings of the Jewish people. These are the shtei brechais tovos, in order to produce something that wasn't there before. Okay, so again, if you want to, Rav Maral goes on and he talks about it, right? You know, he goes on to say the same thing. I mean, it's not, obviously there must be something new, but you know, Maral often expresses himself in a way which seems, you know, repeated, just to bring it out very, very clearly, that he says that you need something from the outside in order to regenerate and in order to develop that which needs to do it. And the farther, v'chol asher yoseh rochek miYisrael, so now he addresses issue number one. He says, it could have been anybody, right? So just bring in somebody from the outside. But the more remote it is, in a certain sense, from the Jewish people, the more of a burst and a flash of newness, of novelty, is going to be there. And therefore, Amon u'Moav, specifically, because they are so far from the Jewish people that there is a permanent limitation against them marrying into the Jewish people, that makes them the freshest introduction into the Jewish people, because they were so far, so therefore they're going to come in and they're going to be creating something which is truly, truly new for the Jewish people. There's a hischachos, there's something new. Now, that's a bomb, you know, like that's like a big deal, you know. The worse it is, the farther away it is, the more remote it is, the more that it's going to be like shaking things up.
It's like the Taurus.
Huh?
Like the Taurus that had that foul smelling.
I don't know that conventionally by Taurus you have a foul smelling thing, so we have to make sure that there has to be also those who are not so perfect in order to make the whole community. The community is not perfect. Right? So even Paisha Yisrael. Here, maybe it is the same idea. I never heard it that way exactly. Here he's saying, in order to shoot us up to the next level, we need a burst from the outside. And because Amun Moav is so much not part of the conventional inclusion in Klal Yisrael, therefore it's going to be that much more of a breath.
Is that
no?
Simple in Luriana Kabbalah that
the darkest
place is where the greatest lights are?
That is a principle, and it's a principle in the Zayar, which it says, you know, Chashaycha Nahir Migay Chashaycha. The light comes from the darkness, and that's one of the sort of conventional ways of understanding why David comes from such a murky background, because the light can only emerge from the darkness. And the Maral himself spoke about that idea to some degree before, understanding it in this mode of, okay, it has to degenerate before it can regenerate, before it can be reborn. And that's used to explain why there's like this, the whole Bathsheba story also, which is within the Jewish people, but it's with the Znus, you know, such a story with murder and adultery and all the intrigue. Lightness comes from the darkness. Here, I think it's a different aspect. Here the idea is, we need something new to be injected into the Jewish people. So find something which is so foreign to the Jewish people, and then it, by definition, is going to be tremendously new for the Jewish people.
Is that also the incestuous part too, because that's also foreign to us?
I see. You can extend it perhaps to that too. The action is foreign. But here it's like it's a foreign ingredient, not a foreign action. It's a foreign ingredient. Bring them in here, and that will be what it'll be. Now, so he says, but one second, if that's the case, so then why don't we say it as a rule that anybody who's outside the Jewish people, who joins into the Jewish people, is going to be creating a new burst? Why isn't it the rule in general by Gerus, by conversion? And we don't find that. We find, in fact, that Chazal have an ambiguous expression about Gerim. Koshim Gerim Lisrael Kesapachas is the statement of the Gemara, where Rav Chelbo said that Gerim are difficult for the Jewish people like a Sapachas. A Sapachas is a term which we have from Parshas Metzora, which is some kind of a welt, some kind of a boil. So that's difficult for the Jewish people like a Sapachas. Now, you know, there's a big ambiguity about what that means. Rashi, Taisus, they discuss it. Some say the idea is that Gerim are so conscientious that they make the rest of us look bad. Right? That's why they're bad. They make us look bad. They make us look bad by how much integrity they have and how much sincerity they have. You know, it's a big tiny, right? You know the old joke, right? You know, you can't talk in shul, you haven't been from long enough. You know, there's, you know, that's what it is. You know, we pale in comparison to their dedication. On the other hand, there's this other aspect which implies that, you know, it's a unwelcome, so to speak, addition, like a welt, like a wart, like it's a growth, like you know, it's an extra thing. So the Maral says that, you know, there is really a duality to this. That sometimes there is a specter of Gerus that adds something to the Jewish people that's extra, that's redundant, that's not helpful. In fact, there's a principle we have, Mora talks about it in Chulin, of kol yeser kenatol dami. Sometimes when you have something extra, it's like something being removed. It's not helpful. It's not an addition. Not every addition is welcome, like a sapachas, like a welt. He says, but there's also such a thing as a ger, who in fact is not there to add something that's beyond the shlemus, but's helping to bring the Jewish people towards their shlemus. They're incomplete without the addition of this that this person is bringing to bear. So the Maral says, you know, it isn't simple. It's not like any addition is great. There are additions that, in fact, enhance the shlemus, the perfection of the Jewish people, and there are additions that we speak of, you know, like an Erev Rav, you know, like just, you know, additions that only perhaps serve in a negative capacity. And it's ambiguous. And Baruch Hashem, I think even in our time, without the drama of Moav and Rus and David HaMelech, we clearly are blessed with Gerim who are adding to the wholeness of Klal Yisrael in magnificent and beautiful ways. And we also sometimes seem to have, you know, additions that are not necessarily going to be positive and helpful. there's an ambiguity. And there's an ambiguity to the whole, everything in the Geirus enterprise, right, is a matter of being able to sift and refine and find the right, find those who are truly those souls who the Gemara tells us were there at Har Sinai and somehow got, were separated from the Jewish people, and now we're bringing them back to complete that Shishim Ribo, those multitudes of the Jewish people, versus someone who's perhaps just coming to add on, not with reasons that are healthy or good for themselves or for the Jewish people. That's why we give Geirim a hard time. You know, that's why they have to run the gauntlet, you know, maybe not, maybe you don't want it, you know, don't return their phone call right away, you know, stuff like that, because I'm serious, you know, you get them all the time, these things all the time, and it's a tricky balance.
You don't have Jiffy Gear?
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam shehakol nehiyeh bidvarei. Okay. So a step further that we as he develops this thing of Amon and Moav specifically. So he says, but let's not forget. So why is it going to be Amon and Moav specifically? Why? Now this is not. He already said, well, Amon and Moav are the ones who are the most distant from the Jewish people on the one hand. So he says, like this, that you can't ignore the positive aspects of Amon and Moav. You can't ignore the positive aspects of Amon and Moav. Amon and Moav are from Lot. Lot has a connection. He comes from the same family tree as we come from. His sister was Sarah Imenu. Right? Amon and Moav, again, have some chelek, some portion in the eternal Yerusha, the eternal inheritance of Klal Yisrael, of Eretz Yisrael, of the broader, greater land of Israel. So he says, don't ignore that positive piece. Yes. Amon and Moav have within them something which is so negative, so corrupt, that they couldn't even approach the Jewish people in marriage, right? For the generations, forever, right? You're going to find the Benos Moav again. He's going to come to explain that. But there's something on Moav which is so negative and so pernicious that it can't join the Jewish people. And at the same time, however, there's something in there that is literally redeeming. That's literally redeeming. So he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes it this way. To have that originally in Avram Avinu, he couldn't have it in Avram Avinu because of that negativity which was there, it couldn't be in Avram Avinu. But on the other hand, he keeps it, so to speak, to some degree in the family because the positive aspect which is there couldn't exist completely outside of the realm of Avram Avinu. So it's in this nation called Amon Umov, which is in this very, very strange twilight zone of being on the one hand the most removed from the Jewish people, and on the other hand being very connected to the Jewish people. So that it's away from them, because as the poison which it is, it has to be away from the Jewish people. But on the other hand, it's in enough of a place of closeness to be preserved for that good ingredient that's going to come, the brecha tova, the good graft that's going to come from it to add to the Jewish people. So therefore it keeps it in this unique twilight zone called Amon Umov. That's what the Maral draws. Okay, you know, it's a very interesting construct. I don't know what more to say about it than that. It's just, I'm telling you over what the Maral says, nothing fancy to add to it. It's just an interesting contrast. Amon Umov is close, so close, and at the same time so far. So close and at the same time so far. And so it's a perfect place to keep it, to keep some little ingredient of holiness that we're going to need injected into the Jewish people, but we need it away from the Jewish people until the time is ripe for that new burst, for that shock that's going to take us to the next level.
So why not Yishmael and Esau, who share exactly the same thing? They fit that same bill. They're in the family of Avram Avinu. They have a negativity that we don't want, but yet they have kohos that are good.
It's a good question, and I can't answer it, kamos shehi, off the cuff, as such. We don't have these kinds of isurim applying at all to Yishmael and Esav. The fact of the matter is, we don't have these kind of Isurim applying to Yishmael and Esav. Huh?
For Edomi, there's nothing like for a few generations.
But it says, Leisasayv Edomi, Hiachichu, Leisasayv Mitzri, Hiyar Yisav Arzai, and it says, right, Der Shlishi is able to marry in. Der Shlishi is able to marry in already. Mitzri Shlishi, Edomi Shlishi. So they're able to do it. They're not the same permanent distance that we have from them. And so why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu engineer it that it should be by light and not by these? Maybe because Yishmael has more connection. Esav has more connection. So therefore the remoteness wasn't possible. I'm not sure. He doesn't say. Okay. But these are the different ones. The paring down, the potential heirs of the Jewish people, they get, in a certain sense, they get closer and they get farther.
Maybe they couldn't be farther away because they are direct descendants of.
Right, maybe because of that closeness, they wouldn't be isolated to that extent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, he's still developing very, very much this idea of, again, how does it work and why would it specifically be. Oh, 1 second, there's one. Thank you very much. Coming right up. Okay, so he goes on here, the Maral, and I'm following more according to his text because there's these pieces, and he brings the Gemara. The Gemara that says, Maidich Siv Atem Sheshus HaSa'irim Ha'ela Nosanli, right? Rus comes home, and she says that, that man gave me these six barleys. Okay, that's some gift. Says the Gemara, right? Boaz gives somebody six barley seeds. That's ridiculous. What's Sheish HaSa'irim? Chidak V'shal Boaz Gim, I'm talking Sheish HaSa'irim. So I thought, Sheish Soy. It's really six measures, six soyans, six sacks of barley, says the Gemara. Shkoyach. She's going to carry home, as the way of a lady's going to be able to carry home six sacks of barley, right? Right? For sure not a man, but even a lady can't carry six sacks of barley home. Says the Gemara, the six is symbolic. The six is symbolic. Whatever it was, it doesn't resolve exactly how much he gave her. But somehow, it had to have the magic number six. Why? Because Asidim Sheish Tzadikim Lotes Mimena. Because there would be six righteous people who would come from her, who would be blessed each with six brachas. Who are they? David, Mashiach, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, V'Azariah. David, how do we know David? It says by David, V'yan echad min arim v'yam, hini arisi ben Yishai, beis halachmi. And he had six great qualities. Yodea nagein, knows how to be a musician, knows how to play music. Gibor chayil, he is strong. Ish milchama, a man of war. Nevoin dover, understanding. Ish toyar, person of magnificent appearance, Hashem Imoy, and God is with him. Six blessings. So the Gemara says that Doeg was saying it, B'lshon Hara, Doeg was saying it all as a negative thing. In other words, what was that? I mean, these are positive properties, but Shaul was very self-conscious about David, so the more Doeg would talk about his qualities, the more it would make him seem like a negative threat in the eyes of David HaMelech. Sometimes complimenting is Lashon Hara. Sometimes saying positive things about somebody's Lashon Hara, because Lashon Hara is to damage through words. So if you are going to foment discord and jealousy and so on and so forth by saying nice things, that also can constitute Lashon Hara. Says the Gemara, Gemara goes on to explain what each of these specific qualities were, and we're going to leave that right now. This is not for our thing right now. The Gemara talks about it a little bit later. If we get to it, we'll have a chance. We'll get to it a little bit more. But what he focuses on first and foremost is, what's this idea of her having six children, six banim, that the pasuk mentions? And here the Maral says something that is more mystical than usual. More mystical than usual. He doesn't explain it that much. He says that the idea is like this. Because there's banim shenim shechum min habrecha el yayna, or some have as a brecha el yayna. In the old edition, has been a brecha el yayna. Brecha can be the term from, again, a pool of a source, right? That's the famous Tshuva Sarajba that says bracha comes from the term brecha, a source of blessing. And brecha is also, again, this term of a grafting, but of a positive thing. Six children. Where do you have six children? in Mitzrayim, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed the Jewish people with prolific blessing in terms of having children, it was Shisha Bekeres Echad, six at once. Right now, what's the idea? What's the magic of the six? Now, usually when we speak about six in the Maharal, we get into, okay, those are the poles of the three dimensions of this world. Here, he doesn't speak about that at all. He says, Sheish, six, is symbolized in Hebrew by the letter Vav. And Vav is a long, straight line. So this really indicates this idea of a Kav HaNimshach, of a line that sort of just continues. The continuity of Zera, of that which goes on, that which, you know, continues and creates that continuity, that was the six. And it's Zera Emes, it's children that are going to be continuing the way straight, not like most other letters of the alphabet that will turn this way and curl that way and go this way. No, it's going to be the straight. Right, the Vav, the six children, was telling Rus that she was going to be the one to produce for him these children that are going to be the true, direct continuity of the Jewish people. Zera Emes. And the Maharal comments on this, that these are Dvorim Muflogim Ma'id B'chachma. This is really, whoa, you know, it's got to play that background music for this stuff. Right? It's, you know, very, 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 the Twilight Zone theme. Right? They're very, very, very out of limits. Okay, so, Nunu. Okay, now. So now let's get to the ugly beginnings of Amon and Moav. And let's hear, okay, next week's parsha is some good preparation. The ugly beginnings of Amon and Moav. How do we understand that piece of this? How do we understand the ugly beginnings of Amon and Moav? So listen to this. Listen to what he says. It's a really, really creative thought and something which is remarkable. If you're looking in the thing, it's on Tafresh Chav Gimel. In the structure of Machshava that we have in Jewish thought in general, Maharal spoken, we've learned about the Maharal. There's this division between the male and female components of a relationship, which is Tzura and Chomer. Tzura and Chomer. Tzura and Chomer simply means, the classic example of Tzura and Chomer is, take a ball of Play-Doh and we put it down on the table. That's Chomer, it's raw matter. Then somebody comes along with very deft fingers and starts manipulating this ball of Play-Doh and makes it into a beautiful rose. Right? Or, the rest of us might have one of those cutout things, and we place it on the ball of Play-Doh, and out comes a beautifully shaped rose. That's Tzura. That's form. Matter and form, or structure. So, the structure, in a certain sense, is completely metaphysical. It doesn't have anything to it, right? It's easy come, easy go, as we discussed earlier in the Maharal. The Chomer, well, there's a law of the preservation of matter. The law of Chomer is always there. The Chomer is the hard stuff. It's there. You can have something change shapes, but at the same time, the Chomer will always remain, right? The matter will always fundamentally remain. The relationship between the male and female components is in many ways seen that way, that the female provides the material, and the male provides the form. Now, in a certain way, we say this because in the relationship, physically, the way we see it, the male acts upon the female. And in certain ways, that's the way we see in general, that Tzura acts upon Chomer. The female certainly does seem to be the one where the raw material is generated, built within herself. She has the egg. Right, the man provides the seed. So, you know, scientifically, to divide up what's Tzura, what's Chomer, I can't do it. Right? But in certain sense, intuitively, the notion of Tzura is something which is a more fleeting engagement that creates something in that which is always there. And the woman is always there, so to speak, naturally, with the child, cultivating it. Right? Everything there that develops within her, and the husband one shot deal, and it helps develop it into something else. Tzura Chaimer, Ish Isha. Right? The man's name goes on the wife, on the family. Mishpachosim Leitavosim. Right? The name, which is the in a certain sense defining the structure, the specifics. Whereas on the other hand, the woman provides the most basic definition. Right? Is the child going to be considered a Jew or not a Jew? That goes after the mother. What Shevet, what tribe, what family, the nuance, that goes after the father. There's raw matter, chomer versus tzura, versus the shape. So he says every relationship has these two dynamics playing together. And the chomer is different than the tzura. And the chomer is like a counterpoint to the tzura, right? The tzura can function, so to speak, within the limits of the chomer. The tzura can apply itself upon the chomer, but there's a certain point to some degree where it's not able to so completely overwhelm it. Because the chomer, you have to apply go by the rules of the chomer and the limitations and the nature of the chomer of the matter itself. Says the Maharal, there's one situation where the chomer's resistance to the tzura is going to be drastically reduced. And know where that is? By the incestuous type situation that you have over here by the Benai Slot. You could think about it just in... We would say this in negative terms. When you have people marrying within their family, so it's not a healthy thing, right? It's generally not considered a healthy thing. Why? Because the same genetic... Right, the genetic issues, they're just going to be compounded. It's healthier when you have two separate ones. So then, they balance each other. Excuse me, for not being highly technical in this, but there's something to offset. It's not going to reinforce. You don't have this duality. Now, in a certain sense, right, that's what I'm saying is that is your limitation. Right, having that other pool is your limitation on the influence of the tzura that's provided by them, by the one, is offset by the other. So they complement each other and they counterbalance. They serve as counterweights for each other. However, if you don't have that counterweight, so then it's going to be overwhelmingly from that side. You might say, well, both sides are the same. That's what Lot had over here. When Lot was Baal Benosov, when Lot had relations with his daughters, these daughters themselves were formed by him. So in a sense, it was more of the same. There wasn't this weight, counterweight that was present here. It was tzura on top of tzura. Lokach, nechshav hakol min ha'av. Therefore, everything is considered to be from the father. And therefore, these creatures which come from here are more tzura, more heavily taped, laden towards tzura than they are towards chomer. And so says the Maharal, let me give you a couple of consequences of this. He says, number one, since Amon and Moav are defined by the power of tzura, which members of Amon and Moav will be ruled out from marrying into the Jewish people? The males. Because basically, Amon and Moav was this dominance, utter dominance, so to speak, of the male in the relationship. It was the man having a relationship with his own daughter, which is, there's no wife to set him straight, right? It's his own daughter. It's his own progeny. So it's overwhelming the power of the tzura. That defines who Amon Moav is. And therefore the nekevos, the females, who are not dominantly tzura, they're dominantly chomer, they're not included in this limitation. So that's one connotation. That's one consequence of this. And the second is that when it comes to getting a shot from the outside to insert into the Jewish people, to have a radical effect on the Jewish people, what's that shot supposed to be? it's going to be indeed ultimate Tzura. And when you think about it, of course, that's really the job of Mashiach, is this remake completely, as we've been learning in this parak, as is the theme of this parak, this remake of the Jewish people. It breaks down virtually to nothing, right? It's now the most basic chomer. It's lost its shape. It's lost its structure of before. And we're going to have to some degree to start again. So what we want is something with the ultimate overpowering tzura in order for it to indeed bring this to the Jewish people. So you have on the one hand Amun U'Moav as this intensification of the tzura. So for the negative sense, it's defined that way. Stay away from the males. But on the other hand, in the bloodstream, those females that we're going to use to draw whatever is there of Amun U'Moav, they're there to draw this incredible strength of tzura that's going to be there to come into the Jewish people. So he says that Amun U'Moav are the ones that are referred to in the pasuk. Right, the Gemara says in Yevamos that when the pasuk says Yodai poras tzor al kol machmadeh, right, the pasuk for Yud, the 10th pasuk in Megillas Eicha, the enemy spread its hand over all of its treasures, all of the Jewish people's treasures. So the Gemara in the end of the first parak of Yevamos darshins, what does this refer to? It refers to Amun U'Moav. When the nations of the world came into the Beis HaMikdash, so they all ran after all the beautiful silver and gold things that were there. Treasures, treasures, treasures. But Amun U'Moav didn't. Amun U'Moav ran for the Sefer Torah. Why? Because in the Sefer Torah it says, Lo yavai amayni u'maravi b'kal Hashem, that an Amoni and a Moavi cannot enter the Jewish people. So therefore they took it and they wanted to burn it. In a sense, Amun U'Moav are the consummate enemies of the Jewish people because the Torah condemns Amun U'Moav, as we've learned, more than anything else. So says the Maral, look what word it uses to describe Amun U'Moav. What's the Hebrew word for enemy?
Oyev.
Classically, it would be the Oyev. Here it uses the term Tsar. Now a tsar is also can be someone who acts with enmity, right? Tsaroris hamidyanim v'kisem osam. But the term tsar is the same two-letter root as tsura, to provide the shape, to provide the form. Amun U'Moav has this tremendous power of tsura, and yes, as it is, the power of Amun U'Moav in its males and its warriors is absolutely at loggerheads with the Jewish people. The ultimate enemy, Tzura versus Tzura. But when it's going to come to it, so then we're going to actually borrow from that Tzura, to the extent that we can borrow from that Tzura, in order to create the burst of strength that is going to have to come forth within the Jewish people. That's the fundamental thesis. He says, "Tvar Mamukim Oy," very, very significant stuff, deep stuff, and you know, this is the fundamental idea which he teaches here. I think it's a very radical, radical understanding of all of these nuances of Amun U'Moav, of the negative, of the Isra, of the connection to Avram Avinu, of the positive role which they play. Right, this notion of nurturing within a seat of tremendous distance, which is going to be the safest place away from the Jewish people, yet some kernel of Kedusha. And at the same time, nurturing it in a nation which is opposed to the Jewish people because of such tremendous strength of character, which as it is, will be tremendously opposed to the Jewish people, but that strength of character, that strength of the form which they give to things, is going to be something which is going to be very valuable for the Jewish people to tap into in its holy version for change. Right? The Messiah is always associated with change. Right? You know, in order to be able, to do it, right, you need to have this tremendous, tremendous strength of character.
He doesn't come.
Okay. Questions or comments? I want to just give you one more thought from the morale, not related directly, but it's one more thought from the continuation here of this parak, and with that we will conclude. But I would like to, just before we shift gears, any questions or comments on what he has said?
I do have a question. I don't think it's answerable, but I'll ask anyone.
Please.
The choice that was made by Noah was obviously a major sin, and he suffered for it. I don't really understand how, you know, it's almost like that the world couldn't have had Moshiach if he didn't make it. So I know we say if people...
You mean Lot?
Lot, I'm sorry, I meant to say Lot. Thank you very much. So I don't understand how... I know we say that, like, you know, people are doing what Hashem wants them to do, but they still get punished for it. But is that really the answer here? I mean, it's almost like he had to do this in order to create this extra strong surah. But obviously he should never have done it. So, I mean, how would we...
Well, how about Barbara?
That's what I'm asking. Like, how are we supposed to... If everyone did the right thing, Hashem would have found another way to do this? Is that what we're supposed to believe?
You're asking a very, very important and difficult question. How about David and Bathsheba? Another example. David HaMelech says about the story of Bathsheba, Chatasi, I sinned. Right? And from David and Bathsheba came... Now, it's true that the child that was conceived with the original mating together of David and Bathsheba died. Right? But ultimately, that relationship did it. How about Yehuda and Tamar? Right? Yehuda also sinned. Right? He had to tzadkami mani. He had to admit publicly he was with the Zayna. Now, Tamar meant well. Right? So, this is part of this very, very murky thing that, yeah, it seems that Hashem specifically has to plant these seeds in darkness. Does that release David HaMelech of culpability for what he did? Does it release Lot of culpability for what it is? Does it release him? No, it doesn't. But I'll just share with you one thought here, which is very, very basic to this, and talk about a little bit on the reason of David HaMelech. You know, there are two kings in the Jewish people. There's Yosef and David. Yosef and Yehuda. Those are the two strands of royalty that exist within the Jewish people. And there are all kinds of differences between them. But let's focus on one. And that is that Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik. Why is he called Yosef HaTzadik? Because he was sorely tempted and he withstood the temptation. Sorely tempted. Ad kedei kach, of course, to the extent that Chazal have one opinion, that when he went to the house of Potiphar, he went because he was interested in being with her, but then he caught himself in time, whatever, the image of his father, whatever did it, he ended up not sinning. He held it back. Right? And he never sinned. He never failed in that. I mean, did he never do anything wrong? But whatever, in this area, in this critical area, he didn't fail, he didn't falter. Yosef HaTzadik. Yehuda sinned. He was with a Zayna, or someone who he thought was a Zona, somebody who thought, a woman sitting out by the Parashas Drachim, by the fork in the road, by the rest stop, you know. Simply he did. But what did he do? Haida. He admitted. And he did Shuvah. These are the two models that we have. We have, on the one hand, the Ashrei Misha Leichata. Fortunate is the person who never sinned, right? So to speak, the FFB all the way through, you know, I mean, halavai, right? But I'm saying, you know what I'm saying? You know, the one who has withheld from sinning, you know, all the way through, and Mishachata Yasa Tshuva V'yizkaper. Person who did sin does Tshuva and Kalim. Two models of royalty. And Yehuda's is completely based on this. Yehuda Ata Yeducha Achecha. Yehuda, your brothers will acknowledge you, says the Targum, right? At Aideisa V'loi V'hisisa, right? You admitted to your failing, and you weren't embarrassed. And because of that, the brother said, wow, that's a leader, right? The most remarkable leader is the one who's able to say, I made a mistake. Who doesn't get, you know, like feel like a bone is caught in his throat when it comes to saying that? That was the difference between Shaul and David. Shaul, when he was confronted with his sin of Amalek, first he denied it, then he blamed it on the Jewish people, and even afterwards, when he said, okay, you're right, I did it, and it's my fault, but do me a favor, please still walk with me as if I'm the king. He wasn't ready to do it. And Shaul is from the stream of, he's not from Yosef, he's from Binyamin, but he's from Banel Shel Rochel, from that stream. Right? When he sinned, he didn't know how to fix it. David HaMelech, Nosan HaNavi comes to him, and what does David HaMelech say? After the hint, one word, Chatasi, I sinned. Right? I'm responsible. No blame, no denial, no coverage, nothing. Right? He puts it in his tilim. Kasher boel bashova. Right? Tilim nun aleph, the mizmor atshuva. So, why is it that way? Or what is that way? Our Mashiach is what? You know, Chazal tells us, it's written in more mystical sources, that Adam stands for, the three letters that make the word Adam stands for Adam, David, Mashiach. And there's a famous medrash which says that Adam HaRishon was able to see this being called David HaMelech, but he wasn't going to exist. So therefore, he would die in childbirth. So Adam said, I want him to have 70 years of my life. So Adam HaRishon, who was the man, was supposed to live a millennium. He lived 930. David HaMelech lived 70. Together they had that millennium. They had that 1,000 years. What is it? Adam was created as the original man, the ideal man, the perfect man. Let's go, let's just sail through. The world is perfect. Man is perfect. But Adam failed. And since then, since that first Friday, all we've been trying to do is be able to fix it. Right? David HaMelech represents the link to Moshiach, which is to fixing it. To fixing it. So, of course, the Malchus of David HaMelech, the Malchus of Yehuda, is punctuated by failing. And then by drawing victory from the jaws of defeat. Drawing virtue from the jaws of sin. Tshuva me'ava, that turns the negative thing around into something positive. Because that's what you have to learn to do. If we fail, it's very good if we can stop ourselves from failing. It's terrific. But if when we fail, we're Humpty Dumpty, you know, we're falling to pieces and we don't know what to do with it, we don't know how to put it back together again, it doesn't bode well for the tikkun of the world. David, Yehuda, all of these things are to some degree the critical juncture. It's born in sin. Right? David HaMelech has a relationship with Bathsheba. It's a negative relationship, it's a poisonous relationship. The first child has to die. But then what does he do? He takes and he says, you know, I learned from my mistake, and he turns it around. And yes, somehow that relationship with Bathsheba itself becomes something positive. It's not going to be forever tainted. It becomes something positive. And teaching this idea of tikkun is fundamental to moving forward. When Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, the only thing that got the Beis HaMikdash to work, that allowed its doors to open for the Aron to come in, was Bavur David Avdecha Al Tavshik Pnei Meshichecha. Because everybody said, David, right? Hashem had to teach. No. He's a Baal Tshuva, and I accept his Tshuva. He knows how to fix it. If it's broke, fix it. And you can fix it. So it has to some degree. Sin, in the individual situation, is emblematic of this global process which we're in, which is fixing ourselves from what was broken in the broader sense. And that always is possible and essential to the process. So that's to some degree why we would say this, besides the chashecha, the darkness, the light, whatever, all of that stuff. Okay.
In particular with the sin of Yosef, by his desire to...
The near sin, yeah.
It was a near sin. But it is not a definable sin then, the last commandment, that shall not covet thy neighbor's wife. It was not a definable sin. And if it was a definable sin, from what you just said, how can he fix it?
In a sense it is. It's not so simple that, you know, that one transgresses on coveting. It's a big halachic question. If one just covets and leaves it at that, if one stops themselves from acting upon that coveting, So it may, you know, it, even in a legitimate way, you know, acting upon the coveting, it may be okay. But no, I think we definitely would, to some degree, say that there are aspects of failure in there. But in the critical piece, he's not necessarily sin-free absolutely. In the critical piece, which is actual acting on this specific impulse, he knew to stop it before it was too late. He left it as thought, not as action. He left it as an idea, not as action. Yeah, yeah. There was a there's still a critical break before, not necessarily perfection. Okay. So I just want to just end quickly with this last thing, which he says, which is just a nice thing. The Gemara darshans, the Gemara interprets all of these pieces. You know, when Doeg HaAdomi was describing David HaMelech, so it says that he was Yodea Nagein. He knew how to be a musician, and he was a Gibor Chayil, and so on and so forth. So the Gemara interprets what these mean. By themselves, they're compliments. But the Gemara understands them to be deeper, more spiritual compliments. So what's Yodea Nagein? It says more Yodea Lishol. He knows how to ask a question. Right? And then Gibor Chayil, right, is Gibor Chayil, Yodea Lahashiv, knows how to answer, and so on and so forth. He says, why Yodea Nagein is to ask a question? So he says like this, Mishi Yodea Nagein, v'hashol midachas lehem. A person who knows how to make music and a person who asks a good question, they have one character that's common to them. L'fisha Torah misameach levo adam. Torah brings joy to a person's heart. Kashi yishal adam, when a person asks a question, it brings joy to the heart of the person who hears the question, because it opens up his heart. You know, when you don't have questions, so everything's just information. Delight in Torah comes when, what's that? How does that work? Why is it this way? And you open yourself up, say, oh, there's something else here. And then there's room for the excitement of aha, right? The aha moment, right? The resolution. That's the beauty. That's Yodea Nagein. When you ask a good question, there's a music to it. It opens up the heart to looking at it. Instead of just delivering it, the same old, same old. It opens it up to something special. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful vort. I think it's a beautiful insight. I have a specific partiality to it because I have this annoying habit of Friday night asking questions and shul without giving an answer, so that people should be able to do it. And sometimes I don't have an answer. So I think it's a very important part of learning. It's not just delivering packaged goods, you know, packaged things, you know. Open it up. What could it mean, you know, and do it. And, you know, there's one night in the year when it's a mitzvah to ask questions. In Pesach, it's a mitzvah to ask questions. So there's a beautiful verse from Rav Tzadok. Rav Tzadok says, why on Pesach do you do things in the way of questions and answers? So he says, because when you ask a question, you'll say, at first glance, it's the opposite of the morale, but it's the same thing as the morale. First thing, he says, when you ask a question, oh my gosh, what's Pshat here? He says, it's like you're locked. Like you're imprisoned by the question, what's going on? And then you get the answer. He says, on Pesach, a person's supposed to experience bondage and freedom. So he says, the Shaila, what's going on? And, I understand. Right? So it's like the opposite, right? The Yodea Nagein, the Maral said, oh, Nigun opens up your heart. No. Yeah, that's the way it happens, right? The question taunts you and torments you. What is it? And then when you have it, it's a nigun. It's shira chadasha, shibchu geulim. You know, it's like, wow, geschmack. Now I understand. It's a very important thing. It's a very important thing. It's an important way to educate ourselves, to educate our children. You know, don't just give them packaged goods. You know, give them questions. Give them things. Nishka ferlach. You know, the Ravid got upset at the Rambam. He says, why are you asking questions that there are no answers to? You know, when he asked the question about Yediyu Bechira. It's not good. It just plants doubts in the hearts of people. So two things. First of all, the Rambam did ask it. He did ask it. Right? And second of all, even if you accept the Rambam's critique, when you know that a question is the unknowable, so the Mishnah says to us, you know, you're not supposed to explore things that are beyond the ability to know in a person. And when you start involving yourself in those kinds of questions, but the knowable, Gesunter, hey, just because you happen not to know the answer yet, doesn't mean you shouldn't ask the question. Doesn't, you know, the somebody once, not somebody, a number of people over the years have heard this thing. They said, oh, you know, they said how so-and-so became an apikiris. Why? Because he learned the Alar Benel. The Alar Benel's commentary on Chumash, the way he works is that he says, Hashelos. Malvin does it also a lot. But he says, here are the questions. Right? Ask 20 questions. Right? And then, his commentary says, this is the problem was, he only read the questions. That's how he became an apikiris. It's okay. Let's come with the answer. Make music. Hmm?